Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, promoting informed discussion of issues related to California state governance and civic engagement. I'm Zabre Valentine, Director of Voices of Reform, and I want to thank you for joining us for our program, Campaign Finance Reform, California Cities Take the Lead. In this discussion, we'll consider the experiences of four Northern California cities, San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland, and Sacramento, where people are acting locally to change the rules related to funding political campaigns. The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program will be moderated by Tony West, an experienced trial attorney and partner at Morrison & Forrester here in San Francisco, and a former federal prosecutor. Mr. West is also an executive committee member of the Bar Association of San Francisco and serves on the board of UC Hastings School of Law. He was named by the Daily Journal as one of California's top 20 under 40 in 2004. And in addition to his law practice, Mr. West is a frequent legal commentator on CNN Headline News, KCBS, MSNBC, NPR, the BBC, and others. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to Tony West, who will introduce today's panelists and moderate today's discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Zabre, for that very kind introduction, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this conversation as part of its Voices of Reform project. As you heard, we're going to be talking about the experiences of four Northern California cities who are acting locally to change the rules related to funding political campaigns. We have quite an experienced and impressive group of panelists. Let me introduce them to you now briefly. To my left is Chris Greenlee, who has served on the California State Common Cause Board for the past 8 years. Chris Greenlee was the Sacramento coordinator for Common Cause for 7 years and has also been active with the Sacramento League of Women Voters. In 1996, Ms. Greenlee organized the Proposition 208 campaign in Sacramento, which would have limited campaign contributions and expenditures in statewide elections. She's also worked on the federal McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform legislation leading up to its enactment and coordinated the effort that resulted in the Sacramento City Council passing partial public financing at the city level in 2003, which we'll talk a bit about today. Ms. Greenlee holds her master's degree in public administration with a specialization in intergovernmental management from USC, and we're fortunate to have her with us this afternoon. Sitting right next to Ms. Greenlee is Tom Mertens. Tom is entering his third year as the chair of the San Jose Elections Commission, which is currently reviewing options for campaign finance reform in San Jose. In addition to being a public relations specialist, Mr. Mertens is an independent writer, producer, and director of corporate video programs specializing in public transit issues. Mr. Mertens holds a BA from Chico State University. We're fortunate to have his voice and his experience as part of this conversation. To his left is Maria Guillen, who is the San Francisco Regional Vice President for SEIU Local 790 and its principal spokesperson. This local, with a combined membership of 30,000 and representing 30,000 members in the East Bay, Sacramento, and San Joaquin County, includes public employees, classified school workers, and private nonprofit workers. Ms. Guillen led Local 790 support for Proposition O here in San Francisco, which resulted in the passage of partial public financing in 2000 for supervisorial seats, with the option of expanding that new system to include the office of the mayor. It's an interesting experience, which she will share with us today in the course of our conversation. Ms. Guillen is also employed with the City and County of San Francisco in the Department of Aging and Adult Services as a program analyst. And last but not least, sitting next to Ms. Guillen is Dan Purnell, who has served as the executive director for the City of Oakland's Public Ethics Commission since 2000. Currently, the City of Oakland provides public financing for candidates running for City Council and the school board. So he has real hands-on experience with what we'll be talking about today. Mr. Purnell is a former civil litigation attorney with a background in employment, contract, land use, and environmental law. Prior to joining the California Bar, he served as mayor and city councilman for the city of Pinole, chairman of the Pinole Redevelopment Agency and West Contra Costa Waste Management Authority, and city planning commissioner for Contra Costa County. Mr. Purnell is a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley and Golden Gate University School of Law. So welcome to our four panelists. Before we begin, let me take a minute to maybe frame our conversation about campaign finance reform. It's not a new issue. It's been with us for now nearly four decades. In a state as big and diverse as California, it is an unavoidable fact of political life that communicating with the public is a costly endeavor. Campaigns tend to be more and more expensive, even in local campaigns, whether they're city council races or school boards, the cost of campaigning is staggeringly high. The question is whether the way we pay for our political races actually influences the outcome of those races, or more importantly, perhaps, the outcome of public policy. And there have been various debates about whether or not the way that we fund our campaigns has problems. For instance, the time that candidates spend dialing for dollars cuts deeply into time that they may otherwise spend with their constituents, learning about the problems of their communities. Having to rely on a few special interests for significant support can compromise a candidate's objectivity, and we've all read examples of that type of thing happening. An intense focus on big dollar donations from a few key interests can make people like you and I feel a bit irrelevant to the process and may impugn the integrity of the political process. The high cost of campaigns can also create a barrier to recruiting more qualified candidates who, but for the cost of running a political race, would themselves become competitive. And the argument would be that it reduces the lack of any real campaign finance reform, reduces the competitiveness of these races. And so there are a lot of reasons out there that individuals and people have debated why campaign finance reform is necessary. And there are lots of different types of campaign finance reform. It can mean a lot of different things, from better disclosure to spending and contribution caps, as you have in San Jose, or public financing, which we'll be talking about today. Partial public financing, called matching funds, that's something that we are pretty familiar with, and it's something I think you see in Oakland and Sacramento and San Francisco. And then, of course, there are calls for full public financing of campaigns. Clean money is one of the examples. Even on the ballot this November, Prop 89 is a proposal for the statewide funding of elections, which is a ballot initiative sponsored by the California Nurses Association. So all of these debates and efforts are going on. There is real action going on the ground in cities around California. And the question, which I will pose to you, Chris Greenlee, is with 25 states and 13 local jurisdictions on the campaign finance reform bandwagon, Why was it important for Sacramento to add its name to that list?
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here today. Well, as you said, Sacramento actually became the 12th city in the country to have a partial public financing program September 9th, 2003. And this ended a very hard struggle, 5.5-year fight that I coordinated, and we're all very proud of it. But you may not know, and I think it's part of my answer, the history of this. Sacramento County in 1986 was actually the first locality to pass partial public financing. It was a vote of the people, and way back then, by 61% to 39%, they voted overwhelmingly to have this kind of a program. The Board of Supervisors enacted it immediately, but then came Proposition 73. And as some of you might know, as an arm of the state, a county could not have a public financing program and still can't unless that's overturned. And so that ordinance exists today. It's never been rescinded. It's just waiting to be overturned. But it was the first in the country. And then in 1990, the City Council of Sacramento, way before I had even moved there, put an advisory vote on the ballot. And again, by almost the same numbers, 57 to 39% voters said, yes, we want a partial public financing program in the city. But this time, the city council didn't do anything about it. And it sat there and sat there. And 2 years later, they finally passed a bare bones ordinance with some limits in it, but no talk of public financing. In fact, they didn't talk about it so much that when I became involved a few years later, most of the current council members at that time didn't even know the advisory vote had been taken. Proposition 208 passed, with the bare bones ordinance, some of you may know it also contained local limits. And so the city council used this as an opportunity to rescind their ordinance. Some of them actually, we believe, hoped that Proposition 208 would not be in effect. They were right. It was thrown out in the courts. And so we were left with nothing in Sacramento. So when I became involved, I was the coordinator with California Common Cause and the League of Women Voters in Sacramento, and I had worked on these issues for a very long time. And people said to me, why don't you just bring back the old ordinance? And I said, you know, if we're going to do this, this is a clean slate. We have, you know, people that have been interested in this issue for a long time. Let's do the real reform here. Let's have public financing and give candidates a chance to run who otherwise would not be able to. And so we began a very long process, which I'd like to talk about more, building a coalition that I think enabled us to run and win this non-campaign campaign. But I wanted to say we had no money. We had no coalition at the time. We had a staff and a city manager who wished I would go away and voted against what we were doing for 5.5 years. We had a law and legislative committee composed of 4 people, 3 who were dead set against us, all except the chair. We also had a blue ribbon panel of 9 people appointed purposely by the city council to have this issue go away. Only 2 of them were for it, and we managed on September 9th, in the middle of the night, 2003, to win. We changed the final vote from out of 9 people, including the mayor, 2 against, 2-4, 7 against, to a final vote of 6-4 and 3 against. And I think a lot of that was due to the way we really built our campaign and the coalition, which I'll talk about later, hopefully.
Well, I'd like you to, because it sounds like into the vacuum that was created by the absence of Prop 209, you were able to put together a coalition that ultimately met with success. And I want to ask you, Maria Guillen, you are the head of an organization that traditionally has opposed public financing of campaigns, and yet you've taken a leadership role in supporting that effort here in San Francisco, helping to be part of a coalition that was successful here in San Francisco. I want to ask you why.
Okay. Well, Tony, thank you. The question, well, why would a large public union, public employee, local union representing thousands of public employees support public finance campaigns or voter-owned elections? And it's precisely because we do represent thousands of public employees and also hundreds of private nonprofit sector workers. Because if the goal is to have elections that are more inclusive of women and minorities, Well, that plays well with our membership. If the goal is also to have politicians and legislators that focus on issues that working people and community folks care about, well, that is also our agenda. And if the goal is to even the playing field and restrain more powerful corporate interests from running away with the ball and the playbook, well, that's what we're after as well. Proposition O, as Tony mentioned earlier, brought us public financing for the Board of Supervisors. And although they may be controversial at times, I believe our board is one of the most accessible and accountable boards around. And I like to think that they open their doors to us because they know that protecting workers' rights and collective bargaining is a good thing for our city. It is something that will keep a middle class in San Francisco, and it's not because they owe us. We were really excited and proud to be part of this coalition to bring partial public financing about for our mayor's race, because our members have known for a long time that we can't compete with the money the corporate business world funnels into election campaigns. They outspend us, traditionally, 11 to 1. So our members also realize that many of the electeds in San Francisco are not only our civic leaders, they are also our bosses. Our members work in the treasurer's office, the assessor's office, they work for the city attorney, public defender, and ultimately the mayor. So it's in our best interest to make sure that a great candidate with a real passion and commitment to public service isn't denied an opportunity due to a lack of funds. When our members get together to decide on who we shall endorse through our democratic process, one of the criteria that continually comes up is whether the person we think is in our corner and is all there with our issues, whether that person is also a viable candidate. That is really a code for, do they have the money to carry on an effective campaign? So our members are better served if we, in fact, can rid ourselves of that specific criteria. Public support should be gauged differently. So oftentimes we're asked, well, doesn't this money take away from the general fund? Yes, it does. Here in San Francisco, there is a cap, however, and it is limited. And isn't it also in direct competition with our own job security issues or our own wage and benefits issues? And as members, we've discussed this, and we say, yes, it does in the short term, but there are caps in place, as I mentioned before. And more importantly, if we become more enfranchised as voters, because we are the public, our power increases, and if our power increases, the lives of working people will also be protected. That's not even to mention the amount of savings that can be found when you prevent corruption or also political favors. So we've seen those instances as well out there. In closing, let me say, we have often said organized people can always win over organized money. Well, in today's reality, we know that big money can buy big media, and that gets into everybody's home. And we like to think that we have the power to go out and knock on every door, but it is an uphill battle, for sure. But with voter-owned elections, we can change it around to that organized people can win because they are pushing for social and economic justice issues. If the unions are freed up from also raising political funds, we can focus more on organizing the unorganized.
Dan Purnell, Maria talks about the virtues of public financing, so much so that it moved her to move her organization to support it. You in Oakland have actually had to implement this thing, and you've had some success and some setbacks. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you faced in actually being on the ground with public financing of campaigns?
Right, sure. First of all, I'm here today very happily, but not necessarily as an advocate. I think best way of characterizing my role is kind of like a mechanic. It's my job to make the program work, make it run. And having that obligation, I think I can come up with some under-the-hood observations on how the Oakland program has worked and by extension other local programs that might be in effect or might be contemplated in other jurisdictions. I think first and foremost, it's very important to understand is that public financing is at its very core a way of influencing candidate behavior with money. We're trying to get candidates to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, such as perhaps spend more time with their constituents or encourage people who wouldn't otherwise run for office to run for office. You're trying to influence behavior. And whenever you do that, you also have to be very aware of other confounding factors that might also play into the equation. For example, I often hear as an argument advancing public financing is, gee, if all the candidates were publicly funded, they would have more time to address themselves to issues and spend more time talking to voters. Well, maybe. Maybe they might spend their time in their law practice. Maybe they might take the money and continue to raise additional money. And so the thing to be aware of, and the point I'm trying to make here, is that there are a few things more complex and as dynamic as a political campaign. And candidates and the people who work for elections, either professionally as campaign treasurers or consultants or people who volunteer their time, all these have an effect on campaign behavior as well. And you might not be able to achieve all the many goals and all the many arguments that are put forward in favor of public financing. The other observation I have is that most of the programs that I'm aware of are matching fund programs, which basically says we will give you X amount of dollars for every dollar you raise privately. And when you have a program like that, typically what happens is you have candidates submitting copies of their checks that they would like to have matched in some kind of a formula. What that means is that people like me have to go half blind for a couple weeks, a month prior to the campaign, looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of checks and making sure that the signatures match, making sure that we haven't matched this check before. Candidates have been known to submit the same check more than once. And there's a host of factors. There's an administrative load in public financing programs. Who's going to administer it? Who's going to resolve disputes? Who's going to enforce violations? Who's going to do the candidate outreach? Who is going to hold or instruct the candidates on how the rules work? So it's one of those situations where you know go into a computer store and you spend the money for the computer and you're about ready to walk out and the service clerk says, hey, you want some software to go with this? And you just realize, oh my goodness, I've got there are other costs involved and it's in the cost of form of time and resources. The third set of factors that I want to touch on very briefly is, as I said before, is these programs are designed to influence candidate behavior, and there's a lot of concurrent requirements in a public financing program that can affect how successful that program ultimately is. Do you want candidates, as a condition of receiving matching funds, to agree to limit their spending? If so, by how much? Do you want candidates to be precluded from contributing their own money or lending their campaigns money? If so, by how much? Do you want to give public money to everybody who qualifies to have their name put on the ballot? Or do you want to have some test of a candidate's viability, whether financially, that is, their ability to raise private money, or by a signature-type system? If so, what are the thresholds? Do you want to exclude contributions from some segments of the population or encourage it from others? All these things are legitimate questions in any program, and all will have an effect on how successful the program is. And then finally, I think it's very important to understand the inherent limitations of any publicly financed program. And one of the things that hopefully we can get into a little bit later on is it's very difficult to regulate so-called independent expenditures, even with a publicly financed campaign. It's very difficult to limit the effect of a self-financed candidate. A candidate who just decides to say, the heck with it, I'll finance my own campaign and I'll pay for it myself. And the Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo said that's okay. You can't require somebody to participate and limit the amount of money that they want unless they voluntarily decide to do so. And then finally, the nature of what I call the scandal factor. When you give candidates public money, you're buying into their behavior. You're buying a share of, you're buying an interest in that candidate's behavior during the campaign. And if that candidate screws up or if that candidate spends money in an inappropriate way, the first thing that's going to lead in the next day's headline is, did candidate X spend public funds taking his or her spouse to Vegas for a campaign party, or did they buy a car, an Armani suit, things like that. So a lot of different factors in a local program. All of them are important. All of them are very complex, and it's in the process of doing it that you can refine your program on a community-by-community basis.
Those problems, Dan, are exactly what Tom Mertens hopes to avoid in San Jose as he goes around looking at the pros and cons of different public financing programs. Let me ask you, Tom, you've got in San Jose a program where candidates voluntarily agree to spending caps. It seems to work fairly well. If it's working, why try to fix what's not broken?
That's a very good question, Tony. And especially when we have 100% participation in this voluntary spending limits, which also allows us to put a limit on the amount of money per donation that candidates are able to raise. But I think a little bit of history probably would clarify that for us. In San Jose, 15 years ago, it would be considered to be a very politically clean city with very little need for much enforcement of its elections and campaign ordinances. But that has gradually changed now to now within the last 2 years, we've had a serious erosion of public trust in our elected officials. 2 years ago, we had a city council member who was found by the Elections Commission to have violated 24 times our gift and campaign finance ordinance. And was forced to resign. And just recently, we have a mayor and his chief of staff who are under grand jury indictment charged with inappropriately spending public money. And under that atmosphere, the city council and the city and the mayor asked that the Elections Commission independently look into research and come up with a recommendation on 100% financing of city campaigns. To my knowledge, we'd be the only city in California that would have 100% financing. The task is daunting, and I can't emphasize that enough. I think maybe you've heard some from Dan and the other folks who have been involved with campaign finance. It is not a cut-and-dried issue. It is a very complex issue that is generates a lot of spirited debate. Just very briefly, what we're doing in San Jose is we're doing preliminary research on the basis of finding out what the constitutional and legal limitations and rulings have been that affect financing by the public of campaigns. We also are looking into all the other jurisdictions that we can find who have public financing in place, and we're asking them to share their expertise with us. And finally, we will be going to the public and having extensive public meetings with the residents of San Jose to find out exactly how they feel about public financing, and then after that, hopefully formulate a recommendation with no promises that that recommendation will be to adopt public financing. In a nutshell, and I think we'll get into these issues a little bit more later on in this conversation, there's two areas that most people that we speak with find are in agreement with, and those two areas are that public financing does indeed seem to diversify the candidate pool and allow people who otherwise would not be able to run for office to go ahead and run for office. The second thing that happens is that candidates apparently are able to spend more time educating and meeting with their constituents and getting their message out, which makes for a better informed public, and which I personally believe makes for a better voting atmosphere in a city. But the third question, which has to do with wealthy public or wealthy special interests, independent expenditures, where is that money going to go if you remove that kind of money from campaign contributions? That question is passionately debated, and I think will be passionately debated for as long as we talk about public funding as a possible remedy for what is perceived to be undue influence and access bought for by wealthy special interests. That's one of the big questions we have, and it's one of the issues we'll be taking to the public and to our stakeholders and to our elected officials in San Jose as we try and come up with an answer that will please most, if not everybody.
I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to a discussion of campaign finance reform, California Cities Take the Lead, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, featuring campaign finance reform activities in the cities of San Francisco, Sacramento, Oakland, and San Jose. I want to go back to something that Dan raised and you touched on as well, Tom, and ask you, Maria Guillen, about independent expenditures, non-candidate spending, as the leader of a large organization that plays a major role in spending and campaigns. What are your thoughts on whether or not independent expenditures or non-candidate spending might actually moot any gains made by public finance reform?
Well, one of the thoughts that I had I was listening to both Dan and Tom was that, you know, I know that we really one of the things I wanted to add to this conversation was that when we talk about special interests or wealthier folks or folks that have large pools of money, it's for certain that the unions have, in fact, had treasuries that we can pull from our particular war chests, as we call them, to help us in our political fights sometimes. And one of the things that we've faced is that we've had a lot of opponents, and we've had legislation being introduced or propositions being placed on the ballot twice, in fact, or they try to limit that. Our ability, right, to utilize this money that we have for political action, and I think it's very, I think it was very disconcerting that the public is always given this face of unions as being a special interest. Special interest is something I think we really need to explore. If in fact, calling for good schools for our children is special interest, or making sure that we have food on the table for our families, or that we have or if we have proper clothing for our children, if that is special interest, then I guess we are guilty of such. But what we've tried to do is again even the playing field, so that we can in fact, if there's possible, as I mentioned before, put the funding that we have into much better use that would bring up the living standards for all of Californians.
Well, it sounds like to me what you're saying is that public financing of campaigns, that's just one and a number of issues which further an agenda that your membership certainly would agree with and that is good for the public in general. So that's just one of many. Let me ask you, Dan Purnell, whether you've now implemented this process on the ground, whether you are actually seeing some of the gains, whether it is in qualified candidates, more qualified candidates coming forward, participating in the process, whether or not there's more integrity in the public's eye in the system. Are you seeing those gains being made in Oakland?
Well, I think it's difficult to assess a program like limited public financing because it depends on what you want to achieve. And as I stated earlier, one of the purported benefits of a limited public financing process is that candidates would have more time to spend on the issues and to talk to people and less time fundraising and that might be it's very difficult to quantify what I have not seen is I have not seen as yet and admittedly the program has only been implemented citywide twice now but what I have not yet seen is an increase in candidates who want to participate. I think there's a number of reasons for that. One is we had the funding pulled from the program back in the election of 2004, and we refinanced it for 2006. And that kind of start-stop kind of is it on, is it off, I think has had an effect. But anecdotally, I think the two things that I have seen is candidates saying, you know, if it wasn't for this program, I wouldn't have been able to put out the mailer that I think was helpful to my candidacy, and for that I'm grateful. And it also kind of helped me make the decision that if I did run, I'd have some additional financial resources to count on. And so in that limited goal, I'd say yes, it has made a difference. Will it bring in more candidates to participate in the future? Will it allow candidates to spend more time on the issues? Maybe. I think the jury's still out. But, you know, I think another consequence is these programs take time to work their way into the political culture of any community. And when it becomes common knowledge that public financing is a part of the process and is going to be there, and that fact becomes a factor in the decision to run for office, then I think you're going to be able to start measuring those gains.
And it does take time, and I think it would be unfair to ask you, Chris Greenlee, to measure the progress of your program because it's so new. But let me ask you something a little bit different. There's a public education process that's important when you try to pass public financing reform and when you're ultimately successful, and then educating the public as to what the expectations will be for the success of such a program. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in Sacramento with regard to that?
I would love to, because I think that's really important. I remember speaking at a general meeting of the League of Women Voters. You were asking Tom about, you know, do you fix something that's not broken? And we didn't have a scandal in Sacramento. I always jokingly say that we prayed for one during this time. But, you know, we were smart. We knew what could happen. And one of my beefs, I guess, so to speak, with the way that politics is run today is we wait till there is a crisis. And I don't think there has to be. I think a little bit about myself. I come from a background of a lot of people in my family across the country who are political elected officials, all the way from mayors to United States senators and governors, Republicans and Democrats. And I've also worked on campaigns, and I know from experience how difficult it is to raise that money. And I also have friends who are lobbyists, both activist types that have no money, people that get paid something but they have no money to hand out. And I also have a lot of good friends who actually run corporations through my husband's contacts in the Silicon Valley. And they use the term being squeezed off the record because they, you know, especially in these times, want to spend their money on other things besides feeling they have to give to candidates. And so I say this because when this was sort of my baby, I wanted to take that with me out in speaking to people. I didn't want to make this a negative thing, not only because my city council was my audience, but I wanted that to bring that and share that with the community. And I also thought if I was going to ask people to implement this kind of program where they were truly going to have to work on a grassroots level, that I needed to do that too. And so over a two-year period, my babysitter got very wealthy while I was out talking to lots of groups of people. And guess what? I didn't just talk to the usual suspects, the progressives in the community. I made it a point to go out to neighborhood associations or any non-formal group I could find across the whole area, from the fabulous 40s down to the poor areas of Sacramento, to talk to people. And I wasn't surprised by what I heard when I was out, because having been out gathering signatures on the street and running campaigns with hundreds of volunteers, I knew the stories. And it's interesting because you only have to say money in politics, and people get it. They get it because they know the power of money in society. I mean, they know who has the biggest house. They know who has the best school. And not only that, I don't know about you, but my mother and father told me that if I was going to ever borrow money from people, and I really shouldn't do that, I better pay it back. And in my case, with interest. And you know what? That strikes a real strong chord with the average person who doesn't ask about independent expenditures, because they know just instinctively that there is that feeling that if you are helped, you need to help somebody back. And so if you talk to all these groups off the record, you will find that everybody pretty much agrees that the system is broken. And so I never talked about specific candidates or, you know, pointed fingers at people. I talked about the problem, which was really the system. And a lot of times there was a young person in the room, and I love to point to them and say, my real reason for being here is I want to make sure that that young man or that little girl, no matter what kind of background or health problem she may have in her life, feels like she can run and win, you know, elected office. My son's 8 years old now. And, you know, when children are asked, what do you want to be when you grow up, you do not hear people say, I want to be an elected official. And I want to be part of changing that because I think it's an aspiration that's a good one. That's sort of what I brought to all of this. And I think that through that, not having that axe to grind, I and also seeing myself as a coordinator and not a leader of something, I was able to gain that support. And by the end of this campaign, the list was so long that it took a very long time to read the list of endorsements, and especially those targeted swing votes that we needed. One council member, when we walked in, said, Uncle, you got me. You got all mine. I give up. I can't fight this anymore. We're going to do it. But, you know, and I also will say this about building a coalition. Over 5.5 years, you kind of have to be a parent because people have changes in their lives. They get depressed. I went through divorces with people. People wanted to quit. And these were the people that were on my side. And so it was my job to be the cheerleader and keep people together and not let them lose the faith. And I think that's really important. And also the second thing is, Tom, when people are building a coalition, they need to be judicious in using people's time. You don't want to ask people over, I didn't have any idea how long this was going to take, to keep coming down to meeting after meeting. I waited until it was really important, and then they trusted me, and I knew the vote was coming that night.
We've got a number of good questions from the audience. Let me ask this one of you, Tom Mertens. Public financing of campaigns can mean that you have candidates spending that much more time going after smaller donations in order to make the matching funds requirement. And coupled with that, that might be one objection to it. Coupled with that, some object to it because some people don't like taxpayers paying for political races. As you go around and look at different public financing schemes and weigh the pros and cons, have you come across these objections? And if you have, how have you dealt with them?
Certainly the idea of taxpayers' money being spent for political reasons, as some people might see it, is met with some resistance. People know that most cities and most jurisdictions have a finite number of dollars to spend on the city, and maybe they don't think that the political process is the place to spend it. I personally don't really have an answer for that, except that if you're making the political process a more honest one in some ways, and you regain, or in the case of San Jose, regain the public's trust in your elected officials, I think overall the city can benefit in a number of ways, starting with the leadership having the trust of the public and the decisions that the leadership makes. As far as we're not looking at matching funds in San Jose, we are looking at what we're going to have to do to qualify candidates, which means they're going to probably, if this is implemented or if this is recommended by the Elections Commission, candidates are probably going to have to go out and raise a certain number of contributions of a very low amount. Many cities do $5, and they want to get 5 or 10,000 contributions for a candidate to qualify. That basically makes sure that you have a viable candidate and somebody who's not there, who's running on a whim or doesn't have a serious agenda. So I can't really talk to the matching portion of it. I can only tell you what we're looking at in San Jose.
In Oakland, Dan Purnell, have you had occasion to consider what the impact of passage of Proposition 89 at the state level might have at all to your public financing scheme?
As I understand, Proposition 89 is for state candidates. So what you're asking is maybe how is the debate over Proposition 89 could affect it, and I mean it's the program in Oakland is part of law. They would have to, the city council would have to repeal an ordinance, and I don't necessarily think that they would go that far, but My concern is, as in terms of how we do run campaigns in California, you go through the process and everybody ends up with tar on their clothing, even if you win. And I guess the thing that concerns me about Proposition 89 is the campaign that's going to go around. I think there's going to be a lot of mud thrown and perhaps a lot of inaccurate contentions and allegations made that could make it more difficult for a community that's maybe, for example, in San Jose, maybe make it more difficult to get something passed after people listen to 4 months of campaign rhetoric for or against the program. That would be my only concern.
Maria Guillen, have you any thoughts on Proposition 89? And one of the questions from the audience is how SEIU might feel about that.
Well, okay. SEIU, we are a large international union. In the state of California, there are several locals throughout the state, our local being just one here in Northern California. Oftentimes, there's not a lot of consensus necessarily with a larger structure. I know in our local, we have taken a very bold step and stance regarding supporting public finance campaigning. However, our SEIU State Council has taken a no recommendation on Proposition 89, and consequently, at the California State Federation of Labor level, there is also a no recommendation on that particular proposition. And I think it speaks to the fact that there is still a lot of education to do and on this matter.
Well, one of the another question that keeps coming up from the audience is. Deals with this issue again of the influence of non-candidate spending in races, and in particular whether there are any reforms that speak specifically to either limiting or somehow holding individuals accountable for the money that is spent in local elections. And so let me just jump back to you, Tom, and ask you a little bit about San Jose and in terms of whether or not there are things being considered with regard to independent expenditures, whether or not there are any disclosure schemes with regard to independent expenditures that might lessen the impact of non-candidate spending.
Yeah, you actually hit on a couple of areas that are being debated in San Jose right now. The second one, disclosure, is always on the agenda of the Elections Commission. We're always trying to find ways to have more timely, more extensive disclosure in place so that the people who are going to vote or the residents of San Jose can know where the money is coming from for particular expenditures. As far as independent expenditures go themselves in San Jose, independent expenditures are protected by the First Amendment in many cases. And if a person wants to go out and spend $1 million of their own money in support of a candidate the last 2 weeks of an election, there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of their freedom in this country, and they can do that. However, if you raise money for independent expenditures in San Jose, we do have limits on independent expenditures that bear on candidacy for people who are running for office, and that is that there's a limit on the amount each person can contribute to that effort. It's $250. In fact, we have a case before us right now where an entity got involved in our mayor's in the first election this year and against a candidate and was found in violation of our ordinance. But independent expenditures by themselves, people have the right to voice their opinion. I believe the Supreme Court's only allowed us to limit a contribution if it's in the case of a candidacy.
If I could just jump in real quick, one of my observations too is I think the more successful programs that deal with limited public financing are also integrated with other types of campaign finance regulation, and so. There's a temptation to perceive public financing as kind of a cure-all, and it's really not. But I think if it works in conjunction with other types of regulations, it can be effective at encouraging certain types of behavior. And so one of the things, you know, that I always look at different programs is, well, what is the cap on direct contributions? And some jurisdictions have a very low cap on how much a person can give to a candidate, and some have higher. And if you make those contribution limits too low, well, you know, where's the money going to go then? Or if you make the voluntary expenditure limit as a condition of receiving matching funds too low, you know, money in politics is like rain hitting an old house. I mean, it's going to find a way to get in. The question is where do you want it to flow? Where do you want it to flow in an open way, or do you want it to find some nook or cranny in which it gets in? And I think that's part of that policy debate for any jurisdiction contemplating a public financing program, is to kind of step back and take a holistic look at the process. It requires an understanding of what that process is, requires people telling you, you know, relying on candidates, relying on campaign consultants, because they're the people who really understand how the program, how the system works, and then figuring out kind of a comprehensive approach of which public financing can be a part.
And it sounds like, it sounds to me, Chris Greenlee, that is what you did in trying to get your reforms passed in Sacramento, exactly what Dan is talking about. Let me ask you to comment on that, but also one question from the audience is, how do you ensure that, and how did you ensure and convince the public that your public financing program was not merely going to favor either Democrats or Republicans or some other partisan interest?
Well, I think they could see who I was talking to, and then I was actually helped by the Sacramento Bee, unbeknownst to me, in 2000. They did another poll of their own that asked if people would like to see this happen. And the demographic breakdown of that was amazing. Ethnically, age, gender, and also political leanings, Republican, Democrat, or Independent, everyone overwhelmingly was in support of it. That question actually never was a problem in Sacramento.
One of the, or I should say three questions that have come up have been around giving candidates free media time, and particularly because that seems to be one of the most expensive ways to communicate with constituents. Any thoughts on how free media time might be built into a particular system of public financing reform? Do you have any thoughts on that, Maria Guillen?
That's an interesting thought, and as I mentioned earlier, I know that that is one of the most costly parts or elements of a campaign. And, you know, if we were able to use the media, not just as far as, you know, promoting or highlighting a particular candidate, but really, you know, an opportunity to really show, you know, the difference between candidates and what their particular stances are on issues. If we were able to provide it more as a opportunity to educate the public, I know that is one of the things that we would like to do with our own membership is to engage them in the process, to really try to encourage them to be part of the process and let's, you know, reverse the cycle of apathy that is out there in the public. If it's able to do that, I think that would be a really good use of public funding.
In terms of media, and even in terms of local media, is that something that, Dan Purnell, is that something that's at all come up in the discussions in public finance reform debates in Oakland?
Well, whether you can require a local radio or television station to offer free airtime is happily not one of local jurisdiction. That's one that the Federal Communications Commission regulates that, and that's been an issue bopping around the federal government for a long time. What I can say is, and kind of maybe as a way of a free plug, there's an organization out of Southern California called Video Voter. And this is an organization that is using local cable channels in a way as a kind of a proactive good government tool to use local cable as a way of introducing candidates, giving candidates greater exposure, giving them an opportunity to put their own commercials together using local facilities and resources, and then running these during the course of a campaign. So as people, as I do, who have a few minutes of time and you're trolling through the channels, maybe you'll hit on the local channel and you say, oh, there's so-and-so, I think I'll listen to what they have to say. So that's an option that is more likely to come into fruition on the local level than requiring standard media to give free airtime.
And certainly it's an issue that, Chris Greenlee, as you go through and you're talking to the Sacramento Bee and even Tom Mertens in San Jose, where the local paper, the San Jose Mercury, seems to be very supportive of these types of efforts. Is that part of your conversation in trying to increase media attention to local races, often races which lack that type of media attention? Why don't we hear from you first, Tom?
Given that in agreement with Dan, you can't force any media outlet that is trying to make a living to provide free time. They just don't do it. But you can arrange or require debates between candidates, and that's something we're looking at, is that should we be providing public funding for campaigns, we're going to look into requiring candidates to appear in debates. And we found by experience that when we do have candidates together in a debate format, that we do get media exposure, and it's not hit and miss. It's very concentrated, and you have some control over it.
And I would answer that I know California Common Cause is actively working on some various issues having to do with media. And, it's the same kind of thing. As everyone knows, it isn't the local issue, but it really is in the sense that I happened to be out at some meetings where we were talking to some general managers about covering various things. What they said is that they don't hear from the people often enough, that they want to hear these kinds of things. And it comes down to, if we really put the public pressure out there and people could see that, this is what they said, they would be more than happy to provide those because they want the ratings, and they were open to that. So I think that you can ask for voluntary participation, and I think it's possible to have it. And I wanted to make a comment, if I might, about the independent expenditures. It's interesting to me because sometimes I went out and spoke to different groups who were all obviously policy wonks, and that was the first question out of their mouths. And they didn't have an axe to grind. They really wanted to know about independent expenditures. But other times I spoke, especially to city council members, and they wanted to use this as a reason not to have any kind of an ordinance. And what I said to them is, and I wasn't saying it facetiously, but is that, this is one of the few issues I've ever heard debated by people that are elected to office, that the reasoning is that if there is somebody that's going to slide through the cracks, let's not do it. I mean, when we think about Katrina and what happened, there were people that cheated that system, but we didn't think about not having a program in place for people who needed help. And it really amazes me that, I use the idea of metal detectors in schools that needed it. If there's one gun that can slip through, let's not do it. No one ever talks about other issues like that. The other thing is, we talk so much about the problems with ceilings and spending issues. And I think that for me, what this was really about, again, was the floor. And after 9/11, I was one of the fools who got on a plane a few days later, only to fly down to L.A. for a program on campaign issues. It's the only thing that would have gotten me on a plane. When I did, I heard an interesting discussion by Jan Perry, who had just run for city council there. And she spoke about, this whole, how amazing it was to use the public financing program and how she wouldn't be where she was without it, and how she specifically was able to get, $50 from somebody who didn't have much money. But then she would say, do you have a brother or a sister or somebody else who had just $50? I'm not looking for hundreds of dollars. And she told this amazing story of how she won. And I think that's something to focus on. And then the other thing is, you can write laws. As a policy wonk myself, you want to try to do what you can to discourage independent expenditures. I agree with Dan. We actually accepted higher limits than we wanted to in Sacramento, not making them too low. You can lift limits when independent expenditures are made for or against someone. You can provide additional public funding. There are all kinds of things that you can do. And you know what? The truth is, when you go out and talk to the average person, they just wish those kind of things would go away, because they want a culture where people play by what they perceive to the rules. And I'm not saying that independent expenditures are illegal. They're constitutional. But they really want everybody to have the same pot to work from. And so, you know, I think more disclosure about who the groups are that are actually running these independent campaigns and letting the public say, please don't do that, you know, is important as well.
Well, just picking up on that, and let me ask you, Dan Purnell, you know, given that you're trying to level the playing field among candidates, and given that you're trying to make candidates more accountable to the public, and inform the public, let the public make a real choice between the candidates and not interests who might enter the fray with independent expenditures, isn't the real answer just full public financing of campaigns?
The real answer to what?
The real answer to these issues of trying to level the playing field and ensure that candidates, elected officials, are accountable to the public, as opposed to some matching scenario where you're matching funds and...
Right. I think the term level the playing field is and always will be a relative concept. And some would argue that today it looks like, you know, the face of the moon, and what we really want is something a little less rocky. But are you ever going to get to a position where all candidates can, you know, can participate because they all have the same resources in light of our current, you know, interpretation of the First Amendment? I don't see that day coming soon. But as I said before, you can have a program of public financing, more money, more public money, arguably better than less public money, because, you know, as was said earlier, you know, there are ways you can counter the independent expenditure thing by kind of pumping more public money into the system if it skews, you know, too badly in one direction or another. But failing that, I think that, you know, again, it is a tool to achieve some agreed upon goals, one of them being a level playing field. But so long as we have a system that says a candidate can go out and spend his or her own money as much as they want, or an independent third party to express their views in a newspaper by buying an ad, and then that's unregulated, you're always going to have some degree of inequality in terms of resources. And so I see public financing as a way of making the field a little less rocky, but not equalizing it.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to a discussion of campaign finance reform, California Cities Take the Lead, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project, featuring campaign finance reform activities in the cities of San Francisco, Sacramento, Oakland, and San Jose. And I've been asking you questions that I've been receiving here from the audience. We have time for one more. And it's one maybe about the hopes of campaign finance reform. So maybe, Tom, I'll let you take the first crack at it and give everyone an opportunity to comment on it. Voter turnout among 18 to 22-year-olds is pretty low. And we've been talking about using campaign finance reform as a way of getting more candidates into the process. What about getting more voters into the process? Do you believe that some of the models you're looking at will actually lead to increasing voter participation in our process?
In San Jose, that may be an easier question for us to answer, because our voter mistrust of elected officials is pretty low right now, and I think that if we put things back on the right track, one of the peripheral benefits of that, having the public trust rebuilt in San Jose, will be a larger voter turnout. I really believe that will be one of the results.
Maria Guillen, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I too. I believe that if we build the trust, the people will come. I also believe that recently we had a mayoral election where we didn't have public financing, and as you know, the the candidate that was not successful actually had a large number of young folks, young people active in that particular campaign, and there was a lot of hope generated because of that. And that, like I said, was without that. So I think there is some hope, and I think whatever we can do to you know, further that or promote that is in our best interest. Thank you.
Well, we're out of time, but I think that's a good place to end. I'd like to thank our panelists for their contributions to this discussion. They are Chris Greenlee, State Board Member of California Common Cause, joining us from Sacramento, Tom Mertens, Chair of the City of San Jose's Elections Commission, Maria Guillen, Regional Vice President of SEIU Local 790, joining us here from San Francisco, and Dan Purnell, Executive Director of the City of Oakland's Public Ethics Commission. We also want to thank our audiences here, live in the Commonwealth Club and on the radio, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.